Rating, is well, online.
It's already filled up.
People can go online to kjcc.org
to Carlos Center.
Watch it live streamed.
And that does it for the show. And we have this news. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is the evening news. First, some announcements for you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for your contribution.
Thank you.
Thanks for supporting the good work that KBOO does and keeping everyone stronger together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, KBOO listeners. We appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for supporting KBOO. We love you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Sun Lee. Thank you for donating during our fall membership drive and for everyone who donated early so we were able to end the drive one day early. And without you, we cannot have KBOO Community Radio. So once again, thank you to everyone.
Thanks, you guys. You're the best.
I want to thank you again and say bye-bye.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. In his first official visit to the United States, Pope Francis today spoke to a crowd of 15,000 people with a focus on climate change.
A prospective petition calling for a recall election has been filed with the Clatskanie City Recorder's Office.
This Friday, a group of hunger strikers against fracking will end their 18-day fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, in Washington, D.C.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The Portland City Council today delayed the vote on how to regulate marijuana business licenses. A number of existing medical dispensary owners voiced concern about the new 1,000-foot rule, which requires that dispensaries be at least 1,000 feet from schools and child care centers. For more, KBOO reporter Eric Klein spoke with Lindsay Reinhardt, a medical marijuana patient with multiple sclerosis, who spoke at the hearing today.
We're outside of Portland City Hall, lots of city attorneys being consulted and ordinances being crafted and delaying of amendments and all these things that are so difficult to talk about to a person that doesn't go to city council meetings. What was at stake just now inside?
So what was at stake was that the Portland City Hall had drafted an ordinance that would have been a first-come, first-serve licensee granting for people to have licenses to distribute marijuana in the city. They were enacting a 1,000-foot rule that would have made it to where a recreational facility that's not licensed but is registered with the state could have kind of edged out somebody that has already been operating and licensed under OHA in our state. And so the problem was that we were afraid that small businesses were going to be able to have to force to shut their doors in order to accommodate the new licenses coming in with their 1,000-foot rule. Last week, we testified for 3 hours trying to get them to amend this ordinance to where small business owners wouldn't get edged out and have to close their doors, where patients would be allowed to consume on-site as per state law says in an enclosed locked room, and for the licensing fees to be lower. They came back on Friday with a new version of the ordinance that raised the fees, still wouldn't allow on-site consumption, and made the language even stricter on the 1,000-foot buffer. So today I came here to hold them accountable, because last week they thanked me numerous times for my testimony and told me I was helpful and then went against every single word I said.
The idea is that there's existing medical dispensaries, businesses who are selling to patients, who are looking forward to the October 1st change in the law in the state of Oregon to be able to also sell to recreational customers, customers without prescriptions.
Right. So medical facilities on September 25th need to send notice into the state that they intend on selling recreational cannabis if they intend to do so. So many of the municipalities under a piece of legislation that went through last session under House Bill 3400 are allowed to have local control. They have until Christmas Eve to declare their local control. But many of these local governments are trying to declare their local control prior to October 1st in order to control the sales and the distribution of all of the cannabis.
Right. And so, and your main concern as someone who works at a dispensary and as a patient was that a new business could get their paperwork completed first somehow, either through luck or through cunning. And then because of this new 1,000-foot law that Portland was trying to enact, that new business trying to sell recreational marijuana, that new business would knock the other one off the block. And there could be an established medical dispensary that would then have to pack up and find a new rental space. Is that right?
That's all correct, yes.
Okay, good. So then what happened? Did that just change?
It sounded like it did. So I went up and I testified that everything they had done was the exact opposite of what we asked. And then I asked them to delay their vote until next week in order to write the language in the way we've been telling them for the entire last week that we would have liked to have seen it, which is that medical marijuana facilities get the priority. They're the ones that are already licensed. They're the ones already serving the population. They're the ones already providing the jobs. It's not that we don't want to see recreational facilities. It's that we want to see dual licensing come out of OLCC for places to serve both recreational and medical. And the Portland ordinance forces you to choose if you're going to be medical, and it forces you to choose if you're going to be recreational, and it doesn't allow for any dual. We're trying to delay so that we can see what comes out from OLCC, but those regulations are going to be late. So we have to go ahead and let these businesses declare, are they going to be recreational or are they going to be medical marijuana dispensaries? But we have to do it in a way that the ones that are already open and serving continue to be open and serving. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. And OLCC is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and they're the state agency that's been tasked with regulating marijuana sales for recreational, not for medicine.
Right. So they begin accepting applications for the license come January, and those licenses will not be issued until fall 2016. So it's not appropriate in many people's minds for a medical facility to have to close their doors because a registered rec facility that is not yet licensed intends to open theirs a year from now. That's not good. So we got the vote delayed, which is all I came here to do. I just want to see their language get changed. It sounded like they still didn't understand why their language is detrimental. Then they had Teresa Marchetti come up and explain, in her words, that it's exactly as I said.
Teresa Marchetti works for the city for the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. It sounds like what her role is, just based on her job title, if residential neighbors don't like how a business is operating, they'd go to her to complain, and that's why it's her job to regulate recreational marijuana businesses.
So the Office of Neighborhood Involvement is the one that would be overseeing all of the complaints that would come from that. So yes, it would fall on her. And I do understand them wanting to have things regulated and licensed properly. It's just what they don't understand is that we're not the lottery business and we're not the alcohol business. We're the marijuana business. And because of that, we do not come with the same shortfalls pitfalls that those other industries have. And if they would just look at the Colorado land use studies, or they would just look at the Sacramento, California land use studies, they would see that dispensaries offer a better quality of life in the neighborhoods that they are in, because the security in those around those facilities is improved, and it brings greater security to the neighborhood. And that's been shown over and over and over. But instead, they choose to use alcohol and lottery facilities as their example, which are not comparable to marijuana industry, in my opinion.
Klatskanai is a sleepy community of less than 2,000 people. It was best known until recently as the birthplace of literary legend Raymond Carver. But controversy has erupted in the town over the last few months as charges of open racism in the police department have embroiled the city government. Former police chief Marvin Hoover is alleged to have done a racist dance and compared African Americans to monkeys. Hoover subsequently retired before an official inquiry could conclude. Now the controversy is threatening to unseat the mayor, Diane Pohl. A prospective petition calling for a recall election has been filed with the Klatskanai City Recorder's Office. The petitioners say that Pohl should have publicly supported the officers who reported Hoover's behavior and should not have accepted his retirement until the inquiry was finished. Pohl also published a letter supporting Hoover in a local newspaper after he retired. If petitioners gather 90 signatures, a recall petition for Pohl will be scheduled, although it is not immediately clear when that will happen.
A homeless camp in North Portland that some had hoped to turn into a permanent settlement is facing a sweep by the Portland police perhaps as soon as tomorrow. The camp, which is on North Greeley Avenue, is home to as many as 300 people. The land belongs to the Oregon Department of Transportation, and an ODOT spokesman said that the department's concern was safety with people living close to traffic on Greeley. But a visit to the camp in question shows that all of the tents and sleep rolls are well away from the road. Mayor Charlie Hale's office has said that it is concerned with another homeless camp, Right to Dream 2, which is currently in the process of being relocated. The Greeley camp is supported by several local nonprofits, including a garden next door that has supplied produce to the people living there. Though it is illegal to camp on the land, homeless people have been sheltering there for as long as 10 years. Several have said they don't know where else to go once the police sweep happens.
Postal workers and their supporters in Portland held a picket today in front of the Portland Art Museum, where the Postmaster General of the United States was giving a talk to local business owners. In addition to the picket, two representatives of the group, Community and Postal Workers United, presented a petition to the Postmaster General that had been signed by 1,500 people. The petition calls for the reopening of closed postal facilities and for an end to the privatization of mail service. The protesters challenged the continuing closure of post offices and processing facilities all across the United States. Right now, 68 mail processing plants are threatened with closure, and 5,000 post offices face massive cuts.
We're out here because the Postmaster General is in Portland and is addressing a gathering here at the Mark Building and next to the Portland Art Museum.
And why is the Postmaster General here at this art museum today?
Because there's a meeting of the Greater Portland Area Postal Customers Council, which is an annual meeting of big mailers and postal managers, where they talk about various deals and vendors sell postal products, and the Postmaster General is the keynote speaker at the conference this morning. We have been assured by her security that she will meet with two of us, and Reverend Schweibert here, John Schweibert, and myself will be going in at 10 o'clock to present our concerns, which are that the Postal Service in the last few years has closed half the mail processing plants, eliminating 155,000 jobs, good living wage postal jobs, and relaxed the service standards such that first class overnight mail has gone away, mail is being delayed across the country, the Postal Service own relaxed standards are not being met 40% of the time. The people, vulnerable people especially, rural folks, the elderly, veterans are suffering because of these changes in our mail service.
And are the cuts to the mail processing plants because the mail service is not profitable?
Well, actually, the Postal Service is profitable, and it's been profitable for a number of years. The Internet has taken away some of the first-class mail, but parcel delivery has exploded because of Internet online shopping. So the Postal Service is not broke. There's a myth that the Postal Service is losing money, and what's in fact happened is that Congress has manufactured a fake financial crisis by putting the Postal Service into debt with an obligation that it pre-fund its retiree health benefits 75 years in advance. Meaning that the Postal Service is $15 billion in debt, but in fact has cash on hand and is running the operations. The operations are profitable.
Is that something that's common to fund health care 75 years in advance?
No other agency does it. No corporation would do it. It's 10% of the postal budget that's going directly into the U.S. Treasury, supposedly to be held for retiree health benefits for people who only don't work for the Postal Service yet. Some of them aren't even born yet. And I expect that money's already been spent in Afghanistan.
Right. So this was a political move.
Yes, and we can't help but think that it was a move to attempt to dismantle and eventually privatize the Postal Service.
And Reverend Schweiber, why do you think it's important to protest the Postmaster General?
I think we're doing whatever we can just to try to slow down this process of dismantling of the Postal Service so that we can begin to build it up again into something that's even more valuable to the public than it is now.
And is the what's been the response from attendees coming in to this protest this morning?
I haven't had a chance to encounter the people directly. Someone else was handing out a piece which we developed, which was an open letter, which we now will get a chance to present to the Postmaster General in person, detailing eight questions that we'd like her to answer.
What are the main points in that letter?
Well, just for one example, we ask, since the USPS has already closed the Salem and Pendleton mail sorting facilities and announced the impending closure of other sorting facilities, how many additional days of delay can we expect for first-class mail? And are not such delays in direct violation of the law, which states that, and this is a quote, in determining all policies for postal services, the Postal Service shall give the highest consideration to the requirement for the most expeditious collection, transportation, and delivery of important letter mail. And that programs designed to achieve overnight transportation to the destination of important letter mail to all parts of the nation shall be a primary goal. Postal operations. I don't know how a Postmaster General can ignore the law.
Thanks very much. We're speaking with Jamie Partridge and Reverend Schweibert here outside of the Portland Art Museum Wednesday morning, where a picket line is just wrapped up and security is standing by the door, protecting the interior where the Postmaster General is speaking now. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This will be followed by The Underground, KBOO's monthly program for youth, by youth, at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high of 80, moving to overcast and a slight chance of showers with a low of 57 at night. Today in history, in 1459, Yorkist forces led by Richard Neville defeated Lancastrian troops at the Battle of Blore Heath in Staffordshire, England, a major battle of the Wars of the Roses. The quote of the day is from Neil Gaiman. I lost some time once. It's always in the last place you look.
Water. Water Bureau has revealed a new price tag for the demolition of the reservoirs at Washington Park. After previously stating that the demolition would cost roughly $76 million, the Bureau is now claiming that demolition costs are projected to be closer to $170 million. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Floyd Jones from Friends of the Reservoirs about the new information and other issues with the recent push to replace Portland's historic reservoirs.
I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm speaking with Floyd Jones. She's a member of Friends of the Reservoirs. The Portland City Water Bureau just released some new information regarding the demolition of the Washington Park reservoirs. The Water Bureau is now claiming that that demolition is going to cost an additional $100 million over the budget which they've released in the past couple of years. And besides that, there's a couple other issues at stake here. Floyd, tell me what's going on.
Well, yes, I'm very dismayed that the Water Bureau waited until after their land use process to reveal that they intend to spend an additional $100 million to demolish recently upgraded open reservoirs at Washington Park, which, you know, they've misrepresented this case to the Landmark Commission, to the city, to the public in general, and now they're just looking to continually raise rates. One thing I want to clarify that's been misrepresented in the media over and over again, there is no federal mandate to eliminate open reservoirs. Compliance with the federal long-term two enhanced surface water rule could be met with simply installing the covers that they sold on eBay. It would cost less than $1 million, and we'd be in compliance with that rule. These reservoirs were very well built, the ones that exist there now. When questioned at the Landmarks hearing in recent months, they said that the new reservoir, if they demolish them and they build a new tank, they said the new tank would be unlikely to withstand an earthquake, and that digging in a historic landslide zone, which is where the reservoirs are located, will likely create a landslide problem. And so now, after this process has been complete, the land use process, now they're revealing that, oops, that price that we gave you of $76 million, no, it's likely to be $170 million. And what are we going to get for that? You know, $15 million, a tiny tank, which, again, they represented to the Landmarks Commission. We don't really need the storage there. We're going to be involved in construction for 4 years without any storage at that site, demonstrating year after year we don't need the storage there. It really is quite outrageous, and it's really very sad that Commissioner Nick Fish chose, you know, just to continue the merry-go-round of hiring insiders. The new director is, you know, just one of the insiders at the Water Bureau when they had opportunity to get the best and the brightest from across the nation, and they chose not to. So there is an appeal of the Landmarks Commission, or of the City Council's decision, rather, to demolish the reservoirs at Washington Park. But withholding information, I mean, this is, you know, it should be criminal to have withheld this information from the land use process.
Who's the prime contractor for the Washington Park reservoirs? I know that Mount Tabor and Powell Butte is CH2ML.
Yeah, CH2ML Hill, and you bring up a good point. Powell Butte 2, what did the public get for that? Well, it's the most expensive tank for just 50 million gallons. So think about that. At Washington Park, they want to spend $170 million for a small 15 million. And then for a 50 million gallon tank at Powell Butte, they spent $121 million. And when you talk to utility managers that aren't associated with the Water Bureau, that aren't associated with CH2ML Hill, those on the East Coast, they are flabbergasted that you would spend that much money on a tank. It's just unheard of. And what did we get? 3,200 cracks. That's what we got at Powell Butte, is 3,200 cracks. It was leaking enough to fill an Olympic-sized pool every day. Do you think that's seismically sound, to have 3,200 cracks? You know, these are just boondoggle projects, and since there's no oversight, they have this new body now that were put in place essentially to be PR folks for the Water Bureau. There's been no line item oversight of the Water Bureau. There's no independent oversight. We're not improving our water system. We're creating new problems.
Let's just briefly mention how people can connect with you and be part of this appeal process.
Well, you can go to our website, friendsofreservoirs.org. You could sign up to be a part of the distribution list. You could sign up there to be on the distribution. You could send us an email. You can write to, City Council. They're not very responsive, but they are in charge. And be sure and vote the next round of elections and vote for new folks.
Again, I've been speaking with Floyd Jones with Friends of Reservoirs here in Portland regarding some new information related to the actual cost of the demolition of the reservoirs in Washington Park. Thanks for your time, Floyd.
Thank you.
Who's Jimmy Tardy speaking with Floyd Jones of Portland's Friends of the Reservoirs regarding new estimates by the Portland Water Bureau for the cost of demolishing the Washington Park reservoirs.
It's 5:24, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Phil Graham, the former right-wing senator from Texas, has surprised me. I had assumed he had zero charitable instincts, for he kept trying to kill such poor people's programs as food assistance. "We're the only nation in the world where all our poor people are fat," he smirked. But Phil seems to have developed a new empathy for people who are demonized. Although he's now a Wall Street operative, Graham returned to Capitol Hill in July to express solidarity with victims of bigotry in our country. Wow, Graham standing with Black Lives Matter and oppressed immigrants? No, not them. The former senator was testifying against a new rule requiring corporations to reveal the spread between their CEO's pay and what their workers get. "It's demagoguery," Phil grumped. Then he lurched into the abyss of absurdity by wailing that overpaid corporate chieftains are actually, get this, victims of public bigotry. The multimillionaire snarled that the one form of bigotry that is still allowed in this country is bigotry against the successful. To prove this bizarre claim, Graham cited the specific case of his buddy Ed Whiteacre, who retired as CEO of AT&T in 2007. Ed was widely condemned for grabbing a $158 million retirement package for himself as he went out the door. Graham practically wept as he related the sad story of Whiteacre's heartache. "The guy was actually underpaid," wailed Graham. "If there's ever been an exploited worker, he was exploited. It was an outrage." Odd, since the former senator had never previously expressed the slightest concern about exploited workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps Graham could do a telethon to support ex-executives like Ed, who suffer such soul-crushing bigotry. Please give till it hurts, and don't laugh, for Phil really feels the pain of the rich.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Teachers in Kelso, Washington, despite a court order, remained on strike today, citing a need for a pay raise before they returned to work. Last Friday, a Cowlitz County judge ruled that their strike was illegal under Washington state law. Teachers and the Kelso School District disagree fundamentally about teacher pay. Teachers say they need a raise to keep up with the cost of living. The district cites salaries in nearby Longview to argue that Kelso teacher salaries are fair and they are in line with what other teachers are paid. The strike continues, in contrast to a similar strike in Seattle, where teachers sought higher wages to keep up with that city's high housing prices. That strike saw the public marching in support of teachers despite closed schools and resulted in an almost total victory for the union. School has still not begun in Kelso. Meetings will continue today and tomorrow to try and hammer out some kind of deal.
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Boeing's plans for a completion center for 737 aircraft in China aren't sitting well with IAM District Lodge 751, which represents 35,000 Boeing workers in Washington State. IAM 751 President John Holden says the union will fight to protect jobs that could be threatened by the proposed Chinese facility.
My concern and our members' concern is that any work moved out of Puget Sound is not something we want to see. I mean, we've sacrificed our pensions, we've sacrificed benefits, along with tax incentives in the state, $8.7 billion in tax incentives for some form of job security. And it's not about China. It's really about any work packages that leave the state and leave the country that concern us.
Holden says that Boeing told him the proposed Chinese plant would finish and paint narrow-body 737 planes built in Washington state. Holden says Boeing's Washington workers want to see new work added there, not overseas.
It's about trying to get some leverage to have more capacity and capability placed here in Washington. That's what we're looking for, to keep work here, to keep employees here. And we feel that the citizens of Washington deserve to have a guaranteed number of jobs for those tax incentives.
Good Jobs Nation workers in Washington, D.C. staged a work stoppage Tuesday as the Pope visited the nation's capital. The workers are waging a struggle for higher pay and union representation for workers hired by private contractors to work at federal government sites. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders joined hundreds of workers in a march to Capitol Hill. Sanders says when we talk about morality and justice, we have to understand that there is no justice when so few have so much, while so many have so little. The UFCW is making change at Walmart, and our Walmart campaign is using a new social media effort to reach out to Walmart workers. The effort is aimed at letting Walmart workers hear and learn about efforts of fellow Walmart workers to improve wages and working conditions at the retail giant. The idea is to reach Walmart workers who may want to speak out but are afraid to do it, allowing Walmart workers active in the movement to speak directly to other Walmart workers via social media. WIN is brought to you in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers and by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This Friday, a group of hunger strikers against fracking will end their 18-day fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, in Washington, D.C. The hunger strikers are demanding that FERC stop issuing permits for the pipelines, the storage facilities, and LNG export terminals that use fracked natural gas, and instead heed Pope Francis's call to care for the earth. They will present copies of the Pope's encyclical to the five FERC commissioners. At the breaking of the fast on Friday, there will be music, brief statements, and a procession featuring a 50-foot anti-fracking banner stating, "The United States of Fracking." For more on this, KBOO's Joseph Jordan spoke with Francis Earthington of Douglas County, Oregon, who is one of the hunger strikers.
The first thing I wanted to ask you about is just how are people feeling there?
It's been interesting. A lot of people are very supportive of us. We haven't had too much negative input. Some of the people have been fasting. This is their 16th day out of 18 days and I of a water-only fast, and I have been fasting for 12 days on a liquid fast. Considering all that, the energy is pretty good. People are pretty optimistic and positive, yet a little pessimistic that we actually can get to work for the American people instead of for the industrial fossil fuel complex.
So what is your sort of concrete goal then? Is there something you want them to build or not build?
Well, I particularly wanted to bring to the FERC's attention the problem with the Jordan Cove Energy Project, the LNG liquefied natural gas export terminal proposed for Coos Bay, and the 230-mile-long pipeline that was needed to feed gas to that terminal. FERC put out a draft environmental assessment, and they were supposed to have analyzed all the environmental impacts. Interestingly enough, in August of 2015, a forest fire, the Stouts Creek Fire, one of our biggest fires in Oregon this year, started on the proposed pipeline route. And so the it made us really examine what would that fire have been like if the pipeline had already been buried there. And we felt as though FERC did a very poor job analyzing the impacts of wildland fire on the pipeline. We wrote FERC a letter in August, no response. And so I wanted to actually speak with them in person about this issue to try and get them to analyze it before they release their draft, before they release their final EIS on September 30th. And our Douglas County commissioners have also expressed concern and written FERC a letter. So we hope to change the tide on this project, just speeding forward as fast as it can, just to slow down a bit and really consider if people down here in Southern Oregon will be safe or not.
And did you hear that the Pope gave a speech yesterday about climate change?
I heard that he gave a speech this morning about climate change. He spoke to the White House and to a group of people this morning, and we look forward to hearing the Pope speak to us tomorrow.
And you guys are going to break the fast on Friday, is that correct?
Well, we're going to have a little party in front of the FERC office. We have invited musicians. There'll be various people of faith there speaking and musicians, and we're going to have a little march around the area, and then we are going to deliver the Pope's encyclical to the commissioners. I mean, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the government agency who approves every fossil fuel project, like Jordan Cove. You know, the owners of Jordan Cove clearly stated that the purpose of the project is so they can increase fracking, that they have saturated the domestic market, and if they can't export, they're going to have to stop fracking. I mean, once they put in this complex, it really ties us to fossil fuel use here for the next 100 years.
Is there an eminent domain concern here, too?
Oh, absolutely. Somewhere, we don't know the exact number, but somewhere between 300 and 700 Oregonians would be threatened with eminent domain by the pipeline. Remember, this is a 230-mile-long pipeline that they have to clear-cut a 100-foot-wide swath for that entire area. And 70 miles of that is through our public forest, through wildlife. Most of that is through wildlife reserves. FERC will order them to clear-cut these wildlife reserves. And then there is private landowners that will face the threat of eminent domain. They gave out original offers in 2013, and 90% of the landowners just laughed at the little tiny offers. You know, I'm an impacted landowner. They notified us that they wanted to take 7.8 acres of our land, our very best forest, 100-foot-wide clear cut through our very best and precious forest. And they offered us a one-time payment of $2,290.
Well, thank you, Frances Etherington. I'm going to let you go, all right?
Okay.
That was Frances Etherington of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, who are conducting a hunger strike against fracking and a pipeline set to be driven through Southern Oregon. With KBOO News, I'm Joseph Jordan.
In his first official visit to the United States, Pope Francis today spoke to a crowd of 15,000 people with a focus on climate change. Pope Francis, who has earned the nickname the People's Pope for his vocal commitment to the social justice and environmental causes, will address Congress on Thursday. In the past, he has criticized the unfettered capitalism practiced in most Western countries and has called for mayors around the world to take action on climate change. He has also been vocal on the need for compassion when dealing with migrants. If that issue comes up on Thursday, it would drop him in the middle of a heated debate on immigration that is currently going on in the U.S. Congress. More quietly, he has continued to support the church's anti-abortion and same-sex marriage policies. Instead of a lunch with politicians, the Pope will have lunch with hundreds of homeless people tomorrow before proceeding to New York. Francis, who was born in Argentina, is the first Pope born outside of Europe in more than 12 centuries. He is also the first Jesuit ever to hold the highest position in the Catholic Church. Jesuits, especially those in South America, have a history of supporting the poor and engaging in what is known as liberation theology.
In the latest news from United States-occupied Afghanistan, Taliban militants have warned hundreds of villagers in Ghazni's Dehyak district to empty their homes as soon as possible. In the village of Rabat Sangay, Villagers say that the Taliban has also blocked routes leading to their village, resulting in serious problems for them. Muhammad Ali Ahmadi, the deputy governor of Ghazni province, confirms this warning. He said that the Taliban had warned Rabat Sangi residents to remove the security post of Afghan local police from their area. He added that when the demand was not met, the Taliban distributed night letters in the area warning its residents to leave. According to Ahmadi, the Taliban have planted landmines on one of the routes leading to Rabat Sangi from Ghazni city. The deputy governor said that security forces are with Rabat Sangi villagers and the main route to the area will be cleared of landmines as soon as it is possible.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015. Palestinians march in the funeral of a young Palestinian woman killed by Israeli troops at a checkpoint. Witnesses say troops killed her without any reason. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Hundreds of mourners attended the funeral of 18-year-old Hadil Al-Hashlamon on Wednesday, a day after the teenager was shot dead by Israeli forces at a checkpoint in Hebron. Key witnesses refused claims she attempted to stab an Israeli soldier. Hadil was shot at a checkpoint at the entrance of Hebron's central Ashuhada street after allegedly attempting to stab an Israeli soldier, according to the Israeli army official account. No Israeli soldier were injured during the incident. The Israeli authorities presented no evidence of alleged stabbing attempt. Fawaz Abu Aisha, who witnessed the killing of Hadil, said that Israeli soldiers killed her as she was leaving the checkpoint when the soldiers told her to leave and not to pass. Photos by Fawaz from Youth Against Settlements clearly shows that Hadil was not carrying any knife or any sharp object and she was shot by Israeli soldiers while she was on a distance from them. From their part, the Palestinian National Unity Government has demanded the United Nations to form an international investigation committee to take a look into the circumstances that led to the murder of Hadil. The government said that images captured and published by Youth Against Settlements Coalition revealed that Hadil posed no threat to the soldiers and that the shooting, unlike military claims, was not justified. In other news, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on Wednesday condemned the restrictions on Palestinians' access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound by Israel. Abbas made his remarks during a speech at the opening of a renovated mosque in the Russian capital, Moscow. Under Israel's army protection, right-wing settlers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque and toured the third holiest site for Muslims worldwide. In the meantime, troops did not allow Palestinians from accessing the place to pray on Wednesday. On Wednesday, Palestinian Muslims marked Arafah Day, marking the start of Eid al-Adha festivities. People try to reach Al-Aqsa Mosque on Wednesday and Thursday to mark the holidays, but often are faced with Israeli restrictions. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories right here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joseph Jordan and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Sheila Warren of the Portland Parents Union and Noni Kazi with the Black Student Success Summit about the state of education for Black youth. In the second half of the program, her guest is Avacha, one of the featured musicians in the Jim Pepperfest 2015 this Saturday. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host David Nyman talks with Portland writer, teacher, and editor Liz Prado about her debut collection of stories, Babies on Fire. And at 11:30, the film show checks out what's going on in Central Oregon at the Benton Film Festival with director Todd Luby. Then Don Smallman tells us about the Portland Eco Film Festival, which is kicking off with an outdoor screening and kayak event on the Willamette River at Portland's Selwood Park. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support in our recent membership drive. It's still possible to contribute by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now it is once again time for News from the BOO, our weekly program, on Wednesdays at or around 5:45 p.m. when we hear from folks inside of KBOO about happenings that are happening all around. Tonight we are speaking with board member Del Crescenzo.
Yes.
And Mike and or Monica will be back next week. Hello, Del.
Hello,